let's start off with this work. This is probably one of the best loved works by visitors in the collection at the museum. It's a work by Andrew Wyeth. It's right now it's on display on the fifth floor. It's called Christina's World. And the woman that he depicts in this painting is his neighbor in Maine, Christina Olson. He depicts Olson on her land. She appears to be looking towards the direction of her home. That's her land, that's her home in the painting. And most of us might know something about Christina Olson. Christina Olson was unable to walk, and what they think her disability was caused by polio. And at the time when this painting was made, Olson was middle-aged at the time. So, you know, and also the other thing with Wyeth is an incredibly hyper-realistic painter. It's not a large-scale work, but it's a very detailed work. So my question to start us off is, what is Andrew Wyeth trying to tell us about Christina Olson in this work? What does he want us to understand about Christina Olson by looking at this work? Yes.
What Andrew Wyeth is trying to say, in my estimation, is that because she is disabled, everything is so far away from her. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he made the house so small. Mm-hmm. And I think that he envisioned her far away from anything essentially. Mm-hmm. And she was remote, and a disabled person frequently feels that way.
Okay.
And my question would be, that's the difficult part.
Excuse me.
Why did he paint the houses as he did?
Okay, and why did he paint the house as he did, okay? Anybody? Faith.
Well, actually, I think that he painted the house the way that he did is because he's trying to show you what a struggle it was for her to get the hill, get up that hill. And if it were closer, you wouldn't see her dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, why isn't her upper body stronger? Her arms are almost atrophied. Anybody that has a disability that usually develops the upper body, and her arms are very, very thin. Why do you think he did that?
I'm actually going to just repeat the questions because I have a nice loud voice, and jump in if I get it wrong. What Faith is asking, her question is, why did Wyeth paint Christina's body the way he painted her body, that her body looked so frail, her upper body, and being that this is a woman who had to move her body through her upper arms, why did he paint her in that manner? And also, a fact about Christina Olson is she did not want to use a wheelchair. She didn't like to use a wheelchair. So Faith's question, why did he represent her upper body in such a frail manner? Yes?
Well, given that Wyeth is such a realist, I have to imagine it's representing exactly how her body looked. And it seems somewhat, although happily we don't have a lot of people who have polio now, but it seems from my youth very reminiscent of the way the limbs atrophied in many people. Mm-hmm. I was just at this house 2 weeks ago, so it's amazing to me to see this. So I think that's my answer to your question. I don't know if it is the answer, but because he's such a realist, I would believe that it really was. One thing about this painting is that there is a strand for every hair. There is a strand for every blade of grass in the foreground.
Mm-hmm.
The house looks exactly like that.
Uh-huh.
It's a beautiful home to visit if you're ever up in Rockland, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
It's very photographic, and it's a wonderful, it's an incredible place to be, and it's very much like this. I guess my question is the large question of why is this painting so evocative for so many people?
Okay. Francesca.
What I think when you say that, about it being so evocative, is that it's her, and we feel like we know about her because of the stories, like Paul has been filling us in on history, and from, you know, carefully studying the way Wyeth has painted her body. But I think what remains a mystery is, or there remains a mystery because we don't see her face. And so she will forever be this kind of mysterious figure to us because we don't know, does she have, you know, sort of a pain look on her face that goes along with these hands that are kind of gnarled and the arms that are atrophied and the legs that are, you know, planted in the grass, or does she have, you know, a smile on her face? And so I guess my question is, could she have a smile on her face? Could this be read as a more hopeful painting?
Janelle?
Well, what I was thinking when other people were describing how remote the houses are and how far away and how it kind of maybe sort of suggests like a sort of kind of isolation, I tried to think about how it could be a hopeful picture too, especially because you can't see her face, and like the fact that you can't see her face kind of helps you identify with her in a certain way, because you know that you're looking in the same direction, even if you don't know what her face is doing. And so it seems like the house is, or especially like the house is kind of like the apex at the top, and she's looking, if this is her world, then that's kind of like the triumph at the end. And so maybe she knows, because this is her world, she's familiar with it, and it might be a struggle for her to get up back to the house, but she can do it. She's going to get up there. Or like this is like just her space. And
that's her choice. Like, you know, you guys may be right, because her choice is to not to use a wheelchair or anything, crutches. And she may just be looking back at her house and enjoying the view, even just to get out there and get some perspective on her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Her house and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I guess I don't know if I have a question. My question, I know, is, I guess, what else does not being able to see her face tell us about the painting, or how? What else does that do by not being able to see her face?
Mary Beth?
I guess I would say, not being able to see her face. The first time I saw this painting, before I knew the story, I thought maybe she was attacked or something, just because the way she's laying. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of looked a little tragic to me the first time I saw it. And I, you know, I'm happy to know the story now. It doesn't seem like it's, you know, he knew her and, you know, she was his neighbor and that's, you know, the house and everything. But I don't know, for some reason to me, it just, she looked a little, I don't know, can't see her face, but she looks a little like twisted and distraught, I guess, like she's maybe running away from something or something, or trying to. So I guess my question would be, if we didn't know the story, what else would we possibly think this is about?
Amy?
I think the first time I saw this painting, I was probably about 7 or 8 years old, whether I saw it in a book at my parents' house or in the actual painting at a museum. But I initially thought that it was a young woman who did not have any disability or mobility problems. And partly because we don't see her face, partly because she looks like she has an attractive physique. I didn't initially notice her arms being kind of tall and thin. And that raised a lot of questions, because that was my first response was like, well, what would this young, able woman be doing sitting in a field, you know? And then I sort of thought, well, maybe she just likes to sit in a field. That's her world. She's into nature, so to speak. I guess my question is, does anybody else want to add to the last question?
What was the question?
Yeah, anybody else have any comments or?
Okay, any other comments about Christina's world?
I'll make a comment. I'm basically an architectural historian. So I will focus on the building more and the landscape of the whole thing, because I know Wyeth is very good at that. So I frankly focus much more on this wonderful house and the wonderful barn and the wonderful landscape. So I think my question is, we all react in a different way. And the more we look at something or we hear people's comments, which I find very illuminating.
Okay, and the question is, what question is that, Sybil?
I'm just saying, what else do people see in it?
Go ahead.
You know, putting all this together, I see that also hopeful. You see, it's a beautiful landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah, it can be much more positive. And I was thinking, trying to remember how I saw it. So anybody else have any comments on what you said about when you first saw it? What did you think?
And what was the question?
I liked the way she was describing the first time she saw it as a child.
Anybody else care to share?
I never saw it.
Okay, yes. I'll get to you next.
Yes, I think there's a struggle for her, but it seems to me that it is a positive struggle.
Uh-huh.
The way the arms, the way the body is striving to reach where she wants to, I don't feel that it is a negative. You can see that she is going to get there.
Okay.
And then you have all the light on her body, which I think is something really which shows that it is a major part of the painting,
mm-hmm.
and again to show that she's going to get there.
And the question?
You think she will get there?
You think she will get there? Anybody?
Yes.
Okay, yes. I'm actually going to pause it right here. Okay, great. You actually made it a richer experience. I have richer experience for me looking at this work. I have a love-hate relationship with this painting. And I just love everything you shared. But let's keep moving along. The piece I've chosen here is a piece, and there's documentation of it upstairs, in the Century of the Child exhibit. And it was a project that took place in 1968 in the Modern Museum in Stockholm. And what Nielsen created for this project, he turned one room in the museum, the traditional white cube, he turned into a playground for children. He built a scaffolding. It was like a jungle gym. It was like a tree house. It was like a construction site. Foam blocks were placed on the ground so kids could, you know, jump and jump off things and roll around. The Royal Theater donated an assortment of period costumes for the children to play around with. There were paints provided for the children that they could paint on the walls or paint wherever they wanted to. Nielsen actually contributed 200 masks of carnival masks, and they were masks that represented Fidel Castro, Mao Zedong, President Johnson, Lyndon B. Johnson, and Charles de Gaulle. These were all there for the children to play with. He even had the museum alter their admissions policy, that children up to the age 18 were free, but adults had to pay if they wanted to go in there. And the children were actually monitored through video, and there were people watching the children off-site, specialists in different fields to observe the children at play, and some of the adults off-site or not within the space were watching the children through the video monitors at play. And if you go watch the documentation upstairs, it's just a small segment of documentation. You can watch the children playing, and then you can watch the adults watching the children play on the video. So my question to start us off with is, what are the differences between the ways a child might perceive this installation and the way an adult might perceive this installation? And it was an installation that took place for 3 weeks. And I see your hand up right over there.
All right, the child is saying, yay! You know, and seeing all the possibilities, you know, and maybe trying to decide where they want to go first. And the adult is saying, we have to clean this place up.
Okay.
Question is, one question I was thinking, is this safe?
Okay, great question. Is this safe? Yes.
So taking care of my 4.5-year-old grandson, this is the very first thing I thought of. It's 1968. I'm looking at the protruding pieces of wood, which would be rounded now on the playgrounds that were built today. I was trying not to go there. I really was, because I thought he would love this. But I would be sitting there watching for when he got close to those little things that are sticking out, you know, and did they think about that? So my question is, what was the artist trying to explore in providing such a space, and what did he hope would happen? What was his purpose in providing a free-for-all space, which I would like to embrace?
I'm going to answer this question. Nielsen had been involved in building playgrounds for underprivileged children in underprivileged areas with a group of, working within a group or a community and developing playgrounds for a community. And I want to point out, too, about this work. This project that was set up in the museum was built by anti-war activists as well as students who built the piece or the environment. And I forgot to mention one thing, that record players were provided with a wider range of music, that the children had the choices of what music they could listen to. And according to reading Lars Bang Larsen, an art historian writing about this project, he said the most popular kind of music was Ravi Shankar, dance music from the Renaissance, and recordings of industrial sounds of steam trains. And I also want to jump in and say about that question, is it safe? That actually the authorities did shut it down for a period of a few days because they said that the foam pieces were combustible, the material that was being used. And what Nielsen did is set up a playground outside while they reworked the interior installation, and then it was reopened for children and adults who wanted to venture in there. And according to reading about this installation, not very many children were injured, though there were a few. In the nature of play, some children did get hurt, but nobody... nothing really serious. My question is, what kind of environment would children design for adults?
I don't think children know the difference between real world and adults. I would love to address your first question.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the difference in what the children would do? I think the adults would automatically go to the masks. You mentioned about the volunteers that set this up, and they were politically interested.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's an important thing. I think that the adults would handle it on the political side. The children would handle it a lot on the play side.
Mm-hmm.
And to answer your question, I think that they would... It would be the same. They would expect you to come down to their level.
Mm-hmm.
Most children.
Uh-huh.
My grandchildren.
Okay, and question?
I should just open my mouth. Do you think that the children interacted with the adults at playtime?
Do you think the children interacted with the adults at playtime? Some adults did venture into this installation. Hel?
Well, as a substitute teacher, I can tell you that kids don't really interact with adults or teachers at recess. It's their own thing. So that's what I think to that question. It's a very different culture, a different world, the kids' world, and they don't need adults, honestly, to play. Their playing is what they do best.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a really neat piece for that reason. And it reminds me of these activity centers that evolved like in the 80s and 90s, and still like McDonald's has them with all the balls, which are so much less really creative than that, but it's like kids can just go and throw throw balls around, or, you know, there might be rides, but this seems more creative. And I would guess it is safe if the artist designed playgrounds, you know, I would guess that most of the materials were safe for the kids. And my question is, anyone else wants to join into anything I say or share anything they want to share? That's my question.
As a preschool teacher for many years, I know that depending on the age of the children, that the initial activity that they do is just exploration, finding out about the nature of materials. It's process. It's discovery. It's not like, what are we going to build from this? And also taking things apart, finding out if you can rip a box apart, is really major in terms of children understanding their materials. So I think that's partly what I think of when I look at it here, because I think that they're having fun, but I think part of that was just exploration. And, you know, to go back to the adult thing, I think adults are sort of not only thinking of tidying up, but thinking of, you know, the end product rather than just the exploration process. Mm.
And question?
Question. From this photograph of this installation, what thoughts do we have about adult participation?
What thoughts do we have about adult participation from looking at these images? This image.
As an artist, maybe the adults that participate, I think I might have liked to go in there and start putting, collaging something.
Uh-huh.
So maybe those are the adults that participate. Now I have to come up with a question?
It's up to you if we...
I also want to comment. It's like a wooden jungle gym. Probably in 1968, they still put metal on blacktops.
Mm-hmm.
They were. What did he learn from that, or that was part of 41 of the do, I suppose?
It was child psychologists who were looking at the videos, because it was a chance to see children in uninterrupted play, as well as graduate students. And I don't know what the findings were from, yes?
I have a general question, mm-hmm. because it seems like there are a lot of people in this room that have grandchildren, that children, and I'm wondering what you all have found, whether it's outside these walls right here in Common Senses or up in Material Lab or somewhere else. What makes a successful kind of intergenerational hands-on experience?
Yes.
I'm with my 4.5-year-old, almost 5 grandchild 4 days a week after school. My third bedroom is devoted to recyclables. He, every day when I pick him up, he says, what are we going to do today in the third bedroom? And so I, you know, it drives my husband crazy, but I say egg cartons, boxes, wrapping paper, I mean, and it's just a playground in there. And every day we make a new project. You know, and the interesting thing to answer your question is I always want to finish the project. You know, I want to make something. He's pretty much interested in just like tearing and putting it together, though, not just tearing because he's older, you know, but the process, not as much as the product. But he does like to know we have something in mind. And my question is, what does the title mean? A model for a qualitative society.
Anybody? What does the title mean? Yes.
I was thinking that fun would be part of it, because
instead of qualitative as opposed to quantitative,
yeah,
as opposed to let's add this up and see, you know, do we have the most here, or, you know, see which is the best, or some kind of like, you know, like a rating system, as opposed to is it fun? Mm-hmm. Or is it, what are we gaining here? You know, like, I mean, the values and of what the children are choosing, you know, their own values, you know, as opposed to let's try to add this up, you know, put it into a grid or something, you know. It's more open, qualitative. Society would be more open and fluid and open to creativity and ideas. Mm-hmm. I was looking at my question, to add a question, I was looking at the expressions of the children. You can only see one, really, fully, clearly. So I was thinking about if you have any comments on the expressions of the children or the way they're using their bodies.
Marissa?
I'll jump in. From my perspective, you don't need all the different expressions, as you started to mention, you know, elaborating the gestures or the bodies. I have a 4.5-year-old and a 9-year-old, and what I see in that is full engagement, both, you know, parallel play and participating with each other and the materials, and they are diving under things, and they are turning, you know, they're not posing, they're not aware of us, they're involved in their own thing. And to me, that says they're having a blast. And they're fully caught up in that moment, in that experience. And now I have to ask my question. again, my mind sort of tracks like what the same question of what was sort of found out about this, but I think that steps outside of the possibilities that were opened up by this that don't have to be analyzed in that way. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm interested in whether these children came back again and again, and whether they you know, brought their parents into it. It's not very open-ended. That's sort of a qualitative, very quantitative question. So I'm going to try to think of something. I kind of want to go back to Francesca's question because I'm fascinated. I loved your response to that. I love the idea of a third bedroom and recyclables. And both in terms of the intergenerational, but also just, you know, we're talking about the supplies they're using and the, you know, playgrounds, and I'm always worried about safety too, but what are people doing with their kids or their grandkids right now to engage? A recycling room, materials, what are some other things, or from the educators?
Laura, and then Faith?
Well, that, actually, I have an almost 2-year-old, and, you know, I think that there is a tendency, or at least I have felt the tendency to say, okay, we're going outside now, like, let's go to the playground. Like, that's a space that has been built for safe child play. And the other day we were outside, and I couldn't, like, get her to, like, continue to walk. She kept stopping. She wanted to look at the leaves. She wanted to look at the acorn. She wanted to climb the steps of all of the brownstones along the way. And at a certain point, I was like, I need to abandon my mission to get us to the playground, to the safe play space. This is her play. This is what she is learning and how she's exploring. And so, you know, I, as much as possible, my idea of play for her is very much what she directs, what she says is what she's curious about. And so, my question is, I guess, what are other people's thoughts about the kind of relationship or conflict, if there is one, between like more structured play and self-directed play?
I was just going to say, the whole thing speaks to me of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
If you allow these children to go where they want to go, you see amazing things. And if you intervene, you don't know how high this tree is going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
But my I want to get back to something. Somebody was talking about the title, mm-hmm. and I think the title tells us the child is father to the man, and everything that they're allowed to do here and now is going to be a model for what they are going to do later.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the important part of this.
I'm going to just repeat
okay.
what you said, because I have a louder voice, and jump in, Faith, if I get it wrong, that you were getting back to the question about the title, and you point out that he's using the model, a model for a qualitative society, and the child becomes the father or the child becomes the man, so that everything that the child does is really a model for the world that they will create as adults.
And giving them the freedom to do it.
And giving them the freedom to do it. I'm actually going to pause us right here and just keep us moving along. This is a work that's up in the third floor in architecture and design, and the Born Out of Necessity exhibition. And what you're looking at is a prototype called Social Telepresence. And telepresence, it's currently used by the military, and it allows one to project oneself into a remote location without physically being there. That means if you want to explore someplace halfway around the world, you can do it through technology while you're in the safety of your own office or your own space without physically being there, but you can still experience it, what it looks like, what it sounds like. And what these artists propose, their design is social telepresence. They wonder, what if we use telepresence in a social context? So they created this object, and here there's a video you can watch if you go to the third floor, and they raise questions. Let's say you're a very shy person, that you are so shy you can't even go out on a date with someone. So what you would do is you would get someone who is much more comfortable socially, and you would have this person put on that helmet and go out on a date for you with a person that you secretly adore, while you at home will have the special glasses that will allow you to hear and see in real time of what's happening during that date. Other ways that this work could be applied or use social telepresence, imagine you are someone who is disabled, who has the inability to walk. Put that helmet on someone who is who has the ability to walk, to dance, to run, to jump, and you could actually feel the experience of moving your legs. Even though in reality you don't have that ability, you could feel what that's like. Imagine if you're an older individual, imagine giving that helmet to a young person and experiencing what a day in the life of a young person is like as an older person. So my question to start you off is, and this is, what would you like to use social telepresence for? Anybody? Yes.
I was going to say, my first thing, I guess my first thought is that it would be a good way for people to understand, like, even in conflict, the
mm-hmm.
other side, maybe.
Whoops.
So, you know, you could, there's, like, you don't know somebody until you walk in their shoes type thing, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, or an empathy understanding and conflict resolution if the other side saw it from the other point of view,
mm-hmm.
maybe they could come to some resolution. So that would be where I would maybe like to see it used for, or, you know, I don't know. And then, I guess your question is, what would you want to use it for? An Olympic medalist. See what it feels like to win an Olympic medal. So I guess my question would be, does anybody see any downside of being able to put yourself into somebody else's, situation?
Mm-hmm.
Way to put it?
Yeah.
It just, it, to me, I don't think I would really connect to it. I don't think I would.
radio sci-fi person personally. So someone who is, what do you get out of it? That would be my question.
Okay, I'm going to get to all of you. Yes?
What I would like to do, I work with the elderly a lot. Or say if I couldn't travel anymore, I'd like somebody to take me and go traveling. And then, of course, since I have worked with the elderly, I could see them when they go to watch movies or travelogues.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice for them all to have a helmet and it would make the experience so much more special.
I'm going
to
just jump.
They never got to travel.
I'm going to jump in that the person wearing the helmet is the person who is your remote person who's going out into the world to experience what you choose to experience. But as someone who would be at home having the date in the safety of his or her home, you would be wearing specially made glasses.
So that's why the senior citizens would be at home.
Uh-huh.
Or people never got a chance to travel to be at home.
Uh-huh.
And somebody went traveling. And it would make that travel log a lot much more interesting.
Okay, and question?
Same thing.
Okay, we'll keep.
Use it for?
Okay, we'll keep the same question going. Yes.
So I just had this experience 2 days ago, and I had it when my first son was a little kid, and I gave him a disposable camera. And 2 days ago, I went to a farm with my grandson, and I gave him my iPad. And I didn't know he was fooling around with it. I was taking pictures of the trip, and when I got home, I saw pictures that he had taken of me. And this had happened 30 years ago with my son, with the disposable camera, and I made an album of it. What it was a very tall me shot from a very small person. And you don't know what it's like to be that small person until you see that camera view, which. And so I'm just sharing that. It was great to see the perspective of another person. You know, I mean, and I just realized how big we look to them and how very small they are. And the whole world is at, you know, kneecap length, you know, height. So I think that it's really positive to have the view from another point of view.
Okay. And question?
Oh, God.
If you want, just say keep the same question going, okay?
It's an interesting question.
Okay. Let's keep the same question going, okay? What would you use it for? Or?
Well, I was just saying, not what I use it for, but what I think is very interesting, this was done in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at technology today, as you were just saying, look at what has happened in 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's overwhelming. I mean, you can go on an instant tour and all this other stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So that's the beauty of it all.
Mm.
So that's my interpretation.
Okay.
So anybody else in his thoughts, too?
Anybody else? I agree that in terms of time, I thought about this when I was looking at the work, too, that it was in 2001, and think of how it might have, it has changed. What are the things, when we look at this one, what are the things that you wouldn't be able to experience? Let's say when you're at home and this person, this host is going out on the date for you in this remote area, what do you lose by not really being there in your own physical presence by choosing to have a date in this manner?
You can't participate. You can't react to the person. Can only see how other people are reacting, but you're not part of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You won't be able to receive the flowers.
Okay.
Or smell them.
What?
You don't have that chance to face your fears and get over it.
Okay. Did you?
Isolated.
You don't have the chance to face your fears and get over it and change your life.
You'll stay isolated.
Mm-hmm. Stay isolated. Yes.
The other person.
Oh, that's a very interesting comment. Did everybody hear that?
No.
That the other person, the person who is in the remote area and engaging in the date for you, is using body language that does not belong to you. How would that change the experience?
It's not your experience.
It's not your experience.
Viewing this, I see it as a negative thing rather than anything positive at all. without limbs. They have this false sense of having a limb.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did everybody hear that? I think that's a really interesting comment. And jump in if I get it wrong. What you said is that you don't like this project, that if someone, for instance, if someone doesn't have limbs and has the inability to walk, you're allowing them to project into something that is not real, that doesn't exist. And how did you end that question for it? Because that was great.
Yeah, I forgot what I said. Why would you impose something that unrealistic on someone that really can't deal with it?
Why would you impose something so unrealistic on someone who can't deal with his or her own personal reality? Mm. Anybody? Yes.
I would like to be able to have a sensation of flying, even though I can't fly.
Okay.
You know, I know that's unrealistic, but I won't be able to fly. But
Question?
Question is the same thing. What negative or positive? Or if you, but the same, it's only reminds me of the movie Avatar again, also, because that man was disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when he was in the movie, when how joyous he was when he finally was able to run around, not only run around, but run around being a huge person too. But yes. Is this something that maybe shouldn't be encouraged?
Okay.
Or is it negative to be encouraged?
Is this maybe something that shouldn't be encouraged, or is this a negative project?
Is there a negative side?
Is there a negative side to it? Yes.
For me, from the beginning, as we just have to talk about it, it's a negative project, and I think we can also see it as an intrusion in people's life.
And question?
Did it ever
is it positive or negative?
Say it again?
Is it positive or negative?
Is it positive or negative? Yes?
I was just wondering if it, since 2001, if it ever did get used other than the military using it.
I don't know, actually, if it did, or if it, or how it's being used, or how it's modified. But yes, is it positive or negative?
Well, I'll just go back. I won't use the same example, except that it feels so strong to me that, I mean, I think maybe we're responding to the cold, clinical, mechanical nature of this device. But if you were to say the same thing about why wouldn't you want to read or experience somebody else's culture or somebody else's experience, I don't imagine that most of you would say, well, I don't want to do that because it's not my experience.
But that is someone choosing to do that. Here you're putting a person who is afraid to go out on a date and letting someone else do it for that person, and that person never really experiences the true feeling of going out on the date.
So I would ask, what other people's response to what I said was relative to if it weren't, because I think I'm not limiting myself to the going out on the date aspect of it, but for it to expand a realm of experience that I might not be able to have, why wouldn't that be a good thing if we saw it in a less mechanical, futuristic way?
Anybody? Yes?
Well, it actually kind of reminds me of everybody's relative dependence on social networking, social networks and communicating and socializing online. And I remember when online dating began, and I thought that was such a strange, artificial way to meet people. And anyway, just to kind of generally, I feel like I'm not someone that really participates in social media and all these various kind of online interfaces, because I also find them kind of artificial, but at the same time, I know people that have began social interactions that way, and then they end up being real physical, productive relationships, and so I think, like anything, in moderation, you know, these things can be positive, but in moderation.
I'm actually going to pause us there because we are out of time, but I want to thank everyone for playing in this experiment, and I have to say, personally, as an educator, it was so hard not to jump in to for me personally to observe the rules of the game. But I want to thank everyone for sharing your views and your comments. Okay, so thank you.
I also just want to invite you all to go outside and to play. Outside is Mobile Studio Common Senses, and it is a